It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, we're going to put a face on the horrifying opioid statistics. Deaths continue to increase despite the availability of a heroin antidote. Plus, it looks like we finally have a budget, sort of. But first, women and some men across the country are coming forward with reports of sexual harassment and assault inflicted by men in the workplace. From filmmakers Harvey Weinstein and James Toback to celebrity chef John Besh and actor Kevin Spacey, the picture is getting to be clear. Men in positions of power have been taking advantage of women. And the latest name on that list, NPR's now former senior vice president of news, Michael Oreskes.
It took published reports for this to surface. We're a news organization.
Yeah.
There's a few hundred reporters out there. Why are we getting scooped by the Washington Post on this?
That sigh you just heard is NPR CEO Jarl Mohn responding to reporter Mary Louise Kelly this week. We'll have more on Mohn's response later in the program. But now, joining us in studio to talk about what Pittsburgh is doing to proactively address these issues and others are The Incline's MJ Slaby. Welcome, MJ.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also, Melissa McCart with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, thanks.
And Kim Lyons is a contributing writer and editor with Next Pittsburgh. Welcome back, Kim.
Hi. I haven't been with Next Pittsburgh for a while, but it's great to be here.
Still a freelance writer, though.
For a pen for hire, whoever will have me.
Okay. You're invited to join the discussion. Tweet your questions or comments and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay. It was a year ago, outgoing City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak, who's wrapping up her term in office at the end of this year, she proposed legislation that would bring the Steel City in line with the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It's also known as CEDAW, C-E-D-A-W. The commission's first executive director was hired in September. MJ, this will be the city's first ever intersectional gender analysis. What do we expect to come from this and from this new director?
Yeah, so when I talked to the director earlier this month, the first step is really seeing what data is out there, how we can look at it and put it all together. And then what they'll do from there is see, okay, there's a gap here and there's a gap there. What can we do to fill those data gaps so that the city can make a full picture of what it's like to be a woman in Pittsburgh and the different factors that might contribute to those inequities?
Melissa?
Speaking on behalf of the restaurant industry, it seems like it has now become the top employer in the city. And I think a lot of people's views about the restaurant industry straddles like blue and white collar jobs.
Right.
And I think that how to address it in the restaurant industry will be unique compared to, say, you know, healthcare industry, for example.
Because the types of jobs, the sheer numbers, what?
I think some of it is that there are so many mom and pops, and so there isn't like a corporatizing of that system, and it's having to go in individually and talk to people about how to help recognize what is sexual harassment and how to prevent it. And some of it is just the fact that it sort of has this pirate view lawlessness in the past, and it's just becoming a more professionalized profession in some ways.
Yeah, and you know, that's actually something that you see in the tech industry as well, right? That you see, especially in Silicon Valley and especially in startups, they don't have the established human resources department where you can go and report something when you have a problem. Not that human resources departments are the end-all be-all in a sexual harassment situation, but it's if you don't have it, if you're a startup and you're scrappy and you're sort of bootstrapping it, you don't realize that you need HR or you need to have structures in place for reporting until you have a problem a lot of the times. And I think the restaurant industry is probably a good example of that as well, that until there is a problem, you don't realize that you need to have these sort of structures and formal processes in place to protect yourself and your employees from situations that could be harmful or dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Councilwoman Rudiak also participated in the hashtag MeToo campaign on social media. The movement, about a decade old, started by a woman of color. It invited women and others to share their own experiences, everything from casual street harassment to retellings of even rape and assault. The idea to give the greater world a better understanding of how to help just how prevalent sexual harassment can be.
That actually made me kind of angry, I have to be honest, that putting it on women to once again bare their souls and share their experiences. And at what point are we going to be believed when we come forward with stories about, you know, this happened to me in the workplace? Why again do women have to be the ones to come forward and prove the situation that's happening? The Me Too. I think a lot of women who might have liked to chime in and say, yes, I had this experience, it's still very traumatic and for a lot of women, for a lot of people who have been in that situation. So I think while it's great if it opened up some eyes, you know, of men maybe who weren't aware of how widespread the problem was, why aren't they aware of how widespread the problem was? Why does it take a hashtag to get their, you know, kind of get their consciousness raised about this? This is not new.
I had written an article about sexual harassment in the restaurant industry, and in response I got a slew of anonymous responses from men, ostensibly, who were in support of their colleagues who were women who had been harassed. And I think one of the things that's really tricky right now is we're in this call-out culture on the internet where it's sort of silencing dialogue. And I do think that I hope that on the Pittsburgh level, we can create some places where men and women can talk about, like, what is sexual harassment? How do you combat it? Where I think that in terms of the Me Too campaign, there are men in support of women who did not feel comfortable having their name attached to it. And that's something else altogether.
MJ?
Yeah. While there are a lot of criticisms of the Me Too campaign, when I was interviewing Councilwoman Rudiak, I said, well, what do you want to hope happen next? You know, what should we move forward from this? And she said, you know, I want there to continue to be a conversation, especially with men in the region. And one of the things that she mentioned to me was this gender equity commission and the intersectional gender analysis that they're going to do. So I hope that while there are criticisms of this campaign, I think the thing we should be looking for next is what happens and how people respond and some real tangible things going forward.
Last week on The Confluence, we talked about the outrage over Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown Pittsburgh episode. He's been pretty vocal about how assault and harassment affects restaurants. Here in Pittsburgh, complaints go to the Bartenders Guild. 60% of the reported complaints were regarding supervisors, employers, and coworkers. The other 40% from the customers and the clientele. Melissa, what is it about that workplace that makes women more vulnerable to these attacks?
Well, I think that some of it is the restaurant industry feels like this crew of buddies on some level, and for better or for worse, that creates a fuzziness in terms of boundaries. And then I think add to that, whether it's after work cocktails or customers coming in and having had a few drinks and sort of crossing boundaries, I think that without there being structures in place in terms of this is okay, this is not okay, then people are going to violate others' either space or, you know, move into the direction of harassment. And I think that some of it is there is a lack of boundaries in the restaurant industry.
Okay. So other industries aren't immune. Confluence producer Megan Harris talked to reporter Angela Columbus this morning, who's on vacation from her usual gig covering politics in Harrisburg.
You know, within the actual State House, when I first walked in, I thought to myself, my goodness, you know, where am I? I felt like I was, you know, I had walked onto the film set of Mad Men because, you know, there were all of these, you know, men running around, you know, very purposefully, and they were always surrounded by a, you know, supporting staff of young, both, you know, men and women in all these supporting roles. And I thought to myself, you know, I haven't worked in a nerve center for government and politics before that looked like this.
Are there any indicators you notice in men that let you know that you're safe in their company, that they aren't going to be a problem?
Usually body language. You know, when you walk into a room, if you're doing a one-on-one interview, for instance, when you walk into a room, you can tell pretty quickly whether, you know, somebody is going to just treat you as a professional or whether somebody is going to treat you as perhaps a weaker professional because of your gender. when the door closes behind you, you always get a little nervous about what's to come. I don't see that happening with my male colleagues. I'm actually married to the AP reporter up there, and sometimes when we discuss this, he's like, that's never happened to me. Nobody ever treats me that way.
Have you ever been surprised? Maybe you thought you had a good working relationship with someone, but he did something untoward. How do you handle that?
If it's not ugly and it's not awful, and, you know, I sometimes just ignore it. If it is very blatant, I will say something. Once a male legislator began rubbing my arm while I was writing, and I just asked him to stop. And he did.
And you describe a practice that one female legislator employs to block female colleagues from getting too close, preemptively putting one hand on the hugger's shoulder while using the other to shake his hand. You know, it seems like this legislator was effectively teaching this technique to a room full of smart, ambitious, college-aged women.
Right.
So what does it say that an elected official needs to give a tutorial to other young women about how to avoid being touched in a professional setting?
It means that we've got a lot of growing up to do in this professional setting, and I don't think it is just Hollywood or just politics. It happens in all, unfortunately, types of professional settings. It's the harasser's career, and it's the harasser's reputation that gets ruined when these things come out. So I think speaking out should be encouraged. And it's the first step to navigating that really kind of delicate imbalance of power.
Angela Columbus covers Pennsylvania politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer in Harrisburg. We'll have a link to her piece covering the Pennsylvania Capitol while female on our website at WESA.FM. Angela, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we heard that conversation between Confluence producer Megan Harris and reporter Angela Columbus. I'm going to ask each of the three of you whether you've either experienced something personally or have you been excluded as reporters, not treated equally as reporters because of your gender. Kim, we'll start with you. Go right down the line.
I wonder if it's a matter of being treated equally or being treated differently, that, you know, you're not allowed into the locker room, or you're looked at differently, or you are dressed as honey, or, you know, their smile. Right. So it's those are all things that I think, and both of my colleagues are nodding their heads, that those are things that I think female reporters deal with, that this was traditionally a field that was dominated by men, is still in very much so in many ways. And I think, you know, I was listening to Angela talking, and she mentioned, you know, if there's something that's not too awful, isn't it a shame that you have to have sort of a graduated list of offenses, that maybe touching on the arm isn't terrible, but calling me honey or, you know, assaulting me is bad, that you should have to have a level of tolerance for some of this behavior when most of it is pretty outrageous and shouldn't be allowed in the workplace or in any professional setting.
MJ.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Kim. There are definitely times being called honey, being asked questions like
how, you have been called honey.
Being asked questions like how old you are, personal questions when you're like, I'm
what
just
does your husband
here.
Think of what you're doing? Or
exactly. Like I'm just here to do my job. You know, I'd like you to do your job as well and answer those questions.
Melissa?
Sure. I don't see it in my workplace, but in regard to sources, I've had people call me in the middle of the night and harass me. I've had fake Twitter accounts that show well beyond a lack of respect. And it's one thing if a subject disagrees with something that's written. It's another thing to launch into personal attacks that involve graffiti on the side of buildings, which has also happened. So, and that's about, you know, gender, too.
I'm going to follow up, Melissa, on something you just said, middle of the night harassment. Have any of you experienced sort of a fear of retaliation?
Yes.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. And I think it's even, you know,
is it because of what you have reported, written, or is it because of what you've reported, written, and you are women?
I think all of the above. I think I am pretty active on Twitter, and I, you know, if anyone who follows me knows, I'm pretty active and, you know, engaged. But I frequently will second guess myself before I tweet something. Am I going to get, you know, trolls coming after me or saying something or calling? You know, it's you censor yourself, unfortunately, because you know, that the level of harassment that some women deal with on social media especially is unbelievable. That, you know, being doxxed, having your personal information put out there, information about your family, like that's a very real situation that a lot of women, I think, are conscious of when they're conducting themselves in a public space, that, you know, am I safe here? Am I going to be unsafe if I do X or Y? And it's a shame that you have to modify your behavior, because you shouldn't have to. But the reality is that I think some of us second guess ourselves in those situations, you know, to whatever the outcome might be, that, you know, it's hard to have a full set level of confidence when you know that there's that level of harassment that can occur for seemingly something innocuous.
This week, the Washington Post reported that two women made claims against NPR's senior vice president of news, Michael Oreskes, regarding nefarious actions he took nearly two decades ago while at a previous job at the New York Times. Since then, more allegations have come to light. And NPR CEO Yarel Mohn told staffers yesterday he let them down by not acting sooner. Identity and Justice reporter Virginia Alvino-Young spoke with NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik about the harassment claims that forced out Oreskes. Folkenflik told WESA he's now spoken with six additional women, including current and former NPR employees.
The dismissal of Michael Oreskes is being reported as another failure by a news organization to hold a powerful man accountable. And a lot of what we know has been driven by your reporting. So what steps do you take to reach out to women about alleged instances of sexual harassment and assault, especially among your own colleagues?
You know, reporting on your own institution is a blend of conventional reporting with the same level of vigor and rigor that, you know, I try to apply to reporting on other major national news organizations, and a sense of this is a culture that I am absolutely a part of, and that, you know, these are not only people that I'm doing reporting about, these are colleagues and peers. But I had first heard about this in 2016, last year. I had spoken to a number of colleagues, primarily women, about their concerns about this incident, about how this shaped the perception of Mike Oreskes in the newsroom, particularly among women and more, you know, younger colleagues at NPR. And so I had a base of people I could return to when The Washington Post published its revelations that two women had told NPR of experiences they had had nearly two decades ago. Those two elements together, what the Post uncovered, what I uncovered, together added up to a real pattern and something very troubling. And it, you know, very quickly led to Mike Oreskes's forced resignation.
Since you say that now you have discovered something of a pattern of behavior, what's next for your reporting? Is the process of reaching out to colleagues going to be ongoing, and do you expect to uncover more allegations?
I would say I've spoken to six women who have registered to me episodes that they consider to be harassing, inappropriate, sexually charged behavior. And I think that the takeaway is that within the newsroom, there was already a feel, in particularly in headquarters, but elsewhere, that younger women colleagues could not really trust themselves alone with the network's chief news executives. And, you know, this morning I was able to report that two veteran editors had gone to human resources and a couple other figures in management to relay that concern, not that they had specific instances they could point to, but that there was a concern of toxicity within the newsroom as a result of concerns about Mike. There was knowledge, but not concrete knowledge of what had happened to Rebecca Hersher. There was essentially a whisper network.
Are you and the reporting team, is there a different lens on what you would like to accomplish in terms of transparency in your reporting of your own internal affairs, or are you more driven to maybe shed light on the situation at NPR?
I try to be very transparent, and you know, I'm encouraged to do so by the editors I'm working with on this, to make clear what we know, what we don't know, what questions are left outstanding, what we've done and how we've done it. I think it's important in these moments for NPR to live its values journalistically, and I hope that the audience, that the on the air, that the readership online comes away with that. They get to judge that.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks again for being with us.
You bet.
And of course, Yarel Mohn, CEO of NPR, expected to address the full staff in D.C. today. So final question quickly for all three of you. As we look ahead, how can we both collect these stories and also be respectful of the men and women who trust us with them? What can Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh newsrooms do? Let's start with you, Melissa.
I think I think that we have to continue the narrative. I mean, how are we in 2017 just talking about this now? So I think that there needs to be a way to sort of keep the volley going as a proactive addressing of it, so it's not something that's swept under the rug again.
MJ.
Yeah, I think we need to continue to report the stories. You know, Me Too showed a lot of experiences, but then we need to go farther and to see, okay, how are people held accountable? What are those systems in place that make these things possible?
And Kim.
I think that businesses should take it more seriously. Sexual harassment should be a fireable offense, period. It shouldn't be second chances, third chances, one offense, and you're done. And if people have that sense of this could be end my job and my career, perhaps they will think twice about doing it.
Kim Lyons is a freelance reporter in Pittsburgh. Melissa McCart writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And MJ Slaby is a reporter with The Incline. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on The Confluence, the face of the opioid crisis. That's next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Pennsylvania voters will decide Tuesday whether the Commonwealth should take the first step toward eliminating property tax. State law lets school districts and local governments exempt up to 50% of an area's median home value. A ballot measure would increase that to 100%. And locals weighed in on what they'd like the city flag to look like. It was part of a contest hosted by local blog Pittsburgh Orbit. Find their submissions and more top news at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Opioid-related deaths jumped by 37% last year in Pennsylvania over the previous year. They don't seem to be slowing down. Big drug busts continue across the state. Lawsuits filed by state attorneys general against drug makers and distributors, and now counties are joining in the fight. But is any progress being made to ease the crisis? We're going to talk about that with Susan Baldridge, investigative reporter for LNP Media in Lancaster. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And
how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And in studio is reporter Kirsten Kennedy from the Beaver County Times. Welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you.
As always, you're invited to join the conversation, tweet your comments or questions, and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So last year across PA, about 4,600 opioid-related deaths. Let's get a snapshot. A brief snapshot of what's happening in each of your coverage areas right now. Susan, you reported last week that deaths in Lancaster County have already topped last year's total.
Yes, that's a little disappointing considering that our county, our area has finally come together in a way to join forces to fight this epidemic. So I guess some people have expectations that it's going to be a payoff right away. But it's still a very serious crisis. People are dying every week.
And Kirsten.
Yeah, Beaver County is certainly not immune to increasing overdose calls and overdose deaths. And, you know, I guess it often depends on the area, but we're consistently seeing numbers going up.
Are they still going up over last year? I believe there were like 102 died last year in Beaver County.
I'm not sure of the number where it's at exactly right now, but earlier in the year is projected to be about the same.
Okay. So let's talk about the various steps in the battle. It seems like every week there's this announcement about a major drug bust. Two dozen here, three dozen there, dealers apprehended here in this part of the state, in central Pennsylvania, northwest Pennsylvania, wherever. But is that actually slowing down the pipeline for users? I talked with Attorney General Josh Shapiro.
But I'm also the first one to say that you can't arrest your way out of these crises. That, yes, that has to be a big part of what you do, but you also have to make sure the treatment is available.
And Susan, Josh Shapiro testified, I believe, at a legislative hearing that that you covered as well.
That's correct. And I think that he's absolutely right. And even police on the street level and local district attorneys on the county level will totally agree with that, that they're doing their job and they are busting drug rings as much as they can, but that doesn't seem to stop the flow at all. In fact, as we're getting more coordinated with our efforts, at the same time, the drugs are getting more dangerous and more plentiful. So really, I'm sure for law enforcement, it feels like they're dipping out the ocean with a teaspoon.
Kirsten.
I don't think that officials and police are really measuring success by arrests. I think that when they see in their areas numbers dropping, they're attributing it more to prevention and to outreach than they are necessarily pointing it to drug busts.
We're seeing a number also, all these different numbers of arrests, and you say they're not just measuring success by arrests. Also, saves, if you would, saves by the use of Narcan, naloxone. But is that really a measure of success? Yes, you've saved that life, but that still is the usage going on.
I've spoken with many responders who say that they're often, you know, reviving a person multiple times, sometimes multiple times in a week. So it's not just stopping with saving the life. There has to be follow-up and treatment. And, you know, a lot more goes into it than just reviving a person.
Susan, I believe that concept of saves came up at that legislative hearing we just referenced.
It did. The state recommended last year that hospitals get on board with local providers and come up with that warm handoff that would at least get someone that's knowledgeable in recovery to meet these people in the emergency rooms when they come in. The problem is they don't all come into the emergency room. Sometimes they refuse the ride in the ambulance because they're facing immediate withdrawal, fear of prosecution, even though that's an unfounded fear, and the idea that their lifestyle is going to be changing right out of their hands. So I think we're facing, even with the warm handoff, a situation where it is not easy to get people who have just overdosed into treatment. I think it's a good effort, but I think right now in our county area, we have four hospitals. They're all involved in the warm handoff, and they're getting about a 30% success rate of getting people who have experienced an overdose and were revived with Narcan into some sort of treatment, whether it's outpatient or inpatient.
We have just a minute or so left, and I want to get to you. So there are lawsuits that have been filed by state attorneys general, and also now at the county level, there are lawsuits. Are we expecting anything on this? And I know Beaver County is one of those that has filed suit.
Beaver County is in the process of filing suit against 14 pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, from what
and these are makers of legal prescription painkillers.
Yeah, because when it's pretty well accepted that a lot of this issue has started with prescription medication and overprescribing of powerful opiates. So similar to the tobacco lawsuits of the 1990s, I think that the county is looking, you know, to recover some of the cost of dealing with this crisis.
And Susan, the final question goes to you, and that would be, give us a mood right now. You talked a little bit earlier about the cooperation, the coming together. What is the mood in your area regarding this crisis? A losing battle? It's an ongoing, it's a long-term struggle. What is it?
I would say people are pretty well divided. Narcan has continued to be a very controversial subject, where some people just don't understand the revolving door of it. They don't understand the nature of a substance abuse disorder. And so they're thinking, well, this should be cured immediately. Somebody should stop doing it. But we don't say that to people with cancer. Okay, we're going to give you two treatments, and then we're going to cut you off and hope that your disease is over. So I think the evolution also revolves around understanding this disease of addiction. And that's the only way I think that the solutions are going to stick.
Susan Baldridge is an investigative reporter for LNP Media in Lancaster, and Kirsten Kennedy is a reporter with the Beaver County Times. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're continuing our discussion of the opioid crisis by putting names, faces, and voices to the statistics and looking at the impact on communities.
My district is ground zero in Allegheny County for heroin overdoses in the entire county. 80% of the crimes are related to heroin use, whether it's child neglect, whether it's theft from auto, whether it's burglary, whether it's prostitution. It all centers around heroin.
That's Pittsburgh City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak. Her council district 4 includes Carrick, which is the focus of a multi-part enterprise series by Rich Lord, Stephanie Strasberg, and Steve Mellon. The series is titled Riding OD Road, How an Unassuming City Neighborhood Became the Overdose Capital of the Region. And joining us in studio is reporter Rich Lord. Welcome back, Rich. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Kevin.
So Councilwoman Rudiak's comments about her district being ground zero, it seemed to fit right into what you learned in preparing for this story?
Yeah, if you look at maps of where people are dying from heroin and fentanyl and other opioids, you'll see that in that district in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, the rates are like 10 times what they are in some other districts and 3 times what they are in the city as a whole. So we've written a lot about opioids, heroin, and fentanyl, but we decided we had not really told our readers why it's hitting so hard in certain places and compared to others.
You start by really doing a tight focus, not just on one neighborhood, but on individual blocks. One during an 11-day period that had 3 overdose calls, and there are only, 8 houses on that block?
That's correct, yeah. We had been watching the data, and when we saw that there was a non-fatal overdose, we would show up on that block and we would try to find out what had happened and hopefully make contact with the person who had undergone that overdose. We were on this block in Carrick one day looking into one overdose when all of a sudden the fire trucks and ambulances pull up a few houses down responding to another one. And we said, well, I think we should spend some time here.
What makes this cluster of streets different from others in any other neighborhood?
Well, you know, we weren't too surprised when we looked at Carrick to find that the demographics kind of matched the overall opioid epidemic. It's diverse but mostly white. It's a kind of neighborhood in which you graduated from high school. Often you went on to a manual labor job. That can mean getting hurt. Over the last 20 years, that has meant a pain pill prescription. And pain pills for some people have been kind of a slippery slope to heroin addiction. But what we found was really interesting is that the just plain location of Carrick kind of created a perfect storm for it. It sits between suburban money and communities in which heroin is increasingly popular and these kind of traditional heroin marketplaces up on the hilltop neighborhoods above Southside. What you had was, as heroin became more popular in the suburbs, you just had that suburban money coming right up Brownsville Road to the hilltop, fueling a growing heroin market right next to Carrick. Meanwhile, you had a public housing community called St. Clair Village, which had traditionally been, unfortunately, a haven for some heroin sellers. It was torn down, ending in 2010.
And heavily African-American.
It was. And all of that, most of the population from St. Clair Village then flowed into Mount Oliver, Allentown, and Carrick. And as that's happening, the real estate market is crashing, and absentee landlords are swooping in and buying up properties in Carrick. So you had this cultural churn and this kind of perfect storm that made Carrick the overdose capital of the region.
You point out that Carrick, in your demographics, the city's fifth most populous neighborhood, first responders accounted for 10% of city saves using Narcan when a person overdosing is revived. Though they cover a much smaller portion of the city's population, just 3.3%. Again, those numbers are disproportionate.
There's 10,000 people there, and to have lost 30 due to fatal overdoses in 2.5 years is a big blow. And that's only the tip of the iceberg because the non-fatal overdoses outnumber the fatals probably 10 to 1.
We've been talking a lot about numbers here. Let's focus on people. You met 35-year-old Dana Maxwell, a heroin addict, started with pain pills, I believe you say, then on to heroin. The fatal overdose of the father of her 3 children didn't seem to stop her. The OD and arrest of another man she was involved with didn't. And even her own near-fatal overdoses, those haven't stopped her either. Why?
Well, I mean, just to say one thing there, it seems like she is doing well as of the last couple of weeks. but certainly she's been over some serious speed bumps and tragedies in her life, and yet those have not shaken the grip of this drug on her. We heard the same narrative over and over again. I ended up using pills, as everyone was, it seemed, for a certain period of time. And I tried heroin, and then I, quote, loved it. We heard that over and over and over again. And then it just takes hold, and it grabs you. And we've heard from people who have been clean for 6 years, and then they will be prescribed a pain pill, and all of a sudden it's off to the races again.
Councilwoman Rudiak told me, and I know you interviewed her as well, she told me that 80% of crimes in our district are somehow related to drugs. She also asserts that pain and pain management have been a natural outcropping for her hardworking neighborhood. Historically, it's full of bricklayers, construction workers, nurses' aides. Did you talk to anyone who held some of those trades before becoming addicted to the opioids?
We certainly spoke with people who not only hold those trades, but still hold those trades. Not all of these people turned up in our stories, but there are people who we've had long interactions with who still go to work every day doing hard jobs. And some of these folks will appear in later stories, but they wake up at 5:30 in the morning needing heroin. They go out and get it. And then they go to work to support their habit that day, day after day.
Have opioids become accepted? How are they changing the community? And how is this crisis changing the community?
In a certain subculture, yes, opioids have become accepted. We spoke with people in their late 20s and 30s for whom it was not abnormal nowadays to be a heroin user among their clique. It was not like when I came up years ago, it was unheard of to be in a room with that or to even consider putting a needle in your arm, but that's just no longer the case.
There are some successful recovery organizations in the area, but some residents believe that the recovery houses are actually bringing in the addicts. What have you found out about what can be done? You had a long conversation with Steve Roque, an addict, as are his sisters. They've all been arrested before, and his younger brother fatally overdosed in 2014. Let's hear from Steve Roque right now.
Only if people want the help, if people want to change. That's the only way I can see. There's no town meetings or whatever you want to call it to help people. People are only going to do it if they want to. You can't make somebody do something they don't want to do.
So, Rich, you attended a Carrick Overbrook Block Watch meeting. Block Watch leader Carol Anthony says users are getting free Narcan over and over and over. What was the attitude you heard from these meeting attendees?
Very often we heard that the Narcan should stop or should be limited because, in the view of some people in the neighborhood, it's just allowing people to be irresponsible time and time again. When we talked with users, we didn't find anybody who said, yeah, I decided to shoot up because I figured that someone would save me with Narcan. That's just not the logic going through the user's mind as far as we can tell. So we continue, I think, to hope that when you save someone, it will be a catalyst for change, at least at some point.
No one thinks the solutions are simple. In fact, several of the police officers you spoke to sound almost demoralized as the addicts themselves.
Yeah. In the public safety, I guess, realm, there is almost an exhaustion right now because they feel like they're running to the same houses over and over again and distributing Narcan, and they don't see an end game. But there's a group called the South Pittsburgh Opioid Action Coalition that is trying to do a number of things, including get people to the homes of people who have just overdosed, maybe the day after, and say, hey, we're here to, we understand, we're here to help, we're here to get you to treatment.
Rich Lord is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. His series, Riding OD Road, is online now and will appear in print on Sunday. Rich, thanks so much, and thanks for your work.
Hey, my pleasure, Kevin. Thank you.
Coming up, Pennsylvania officially has a budget, as long as you don't need to know how exactly we're going to pay for it. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first known cystic fibrosis heart-lung transplant is performed at Presbyterian University Hospital, now UPMC Presby, in 1983. Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disorder that can make it difficult to breathe and has no known cure. The operation was done on a 25-year-old patient and took about 6 hours. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for November 3rd, 2017.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It took an additional 4 months after the legislature passed the $32 billion budget, but it looks like the revenues are in place to erase a $2 billion shortfall. Late last week, the General Assembly sent a legislative package to the governor, and Monday he signed most of the bills. Joining us now from the Harrisburg Bureau of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is reporter Liz Navratil. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Liz, does this revenue package come down to betting and borrowing, an expansion of gambling plus taking out loans?
Those are the big elements in there. The borrowing is going to be something to watch. The package calls for borrowing against the state's settlement with tobacco companies, although we know the governor has also recently been working to borrow against, to work with the Liquor Control Board to borrow against liquor profits. So whether both of those go through or only one goes through in the end remains to be seen. The gambling expansion was certainly huge. And then there were some smaller items in there as well. But those are pretty much the highlights.
Okay, let's take them as each individually. The gambling. So The measures do what as far as additional locations to gamble?
Sure. So one of the things people have been focusing on a lot is the creation of the mini casinos. Now, there are some various rules about ways that your area can opt out of them or how close they can be placed to existing casinos. But that's probably one of the largest items in the gambling package. There's also a provision for putting these machines called video gaming terminals, which have been described to me as sort of slot-like machines. At truck stops along the turnpike, although there are some provisions there where different localities can opt out of having them in their area. And then there's some forms of online gambling that are also in this package that we could see in the future.
All right. The fiscal year that ended June 30th, slots revenues were down 2% over the year. Table game revenues up 3%. I asked the governor on Monday, shortly after he signed the bill, what signals are there that the public actually wants greater access to gambling?
It's a good question. I think the idea is has always been to try to figure out if there's actually something that Pennsylvanians would like as an additional option, but that would not simply cannibalize funding from other gambling that's going on right now. And I think this was an attempt to do that.
So, Liz, they're counting on this gambling expansion for about how much money? And is that a conservative estimate? I mean, are they likely to reach that? Why do we have any assurance that they will reach that number?
So the number that we're hearing right now is usually around $200 million. The exact amount might depend on which caucus you're talking to at the moment, which political party is doing the estimates. But generally around $200 million is the number we're hearing. And that question that you've asked is one that a lot of people in the Capitol are asking as well, in terms of will that money actually come in? My understanding is that these numbers are based off of different staff estimates, people with financial experience, but they are, at the end of the day, estimates. So they're based on the idea that you might have a certain number of people trying to create mini casinos or interested in VGTs at truck stops or any of these different provisions. So there are some folks who seem very confident that the money will come in. There are others who question whether it's an overly optimistic number. And I think, truth be told, it's too early to tell at this point whether they will actually get that much money from it.
All right, I'm going to go into a little more detail about the loans, the borrowing that you alluded to at the beginning of our conversation. So the governor proposed borrowing against liquor sales revenues, and the Republican legislative leaders, they want to borrow the money against future payments from the tobacco lawsuit settlement, correct?
So the tobacco settlement plan is one that has been signed off on by both some combination of Democrats and Republicans. So I wouldn't put it entirely on them.
Okay.
But you do raise a sort of interesting issue here. There are a lot of politics involved in these things. The House Republicans have traditionally been more for privatizing the liquor system, which would be very hard to do if the governor does succeed in this plan he's proposed of borrowing against liquor profits. So that might give you a little insight into why there's some push and pull here in terms of which plan to go for. Now, the idea of borrowing against the tobacco settlement is in the budget bills that the governor has already signed. That's not laying out there. But my understanding is they still need approval from one more body to make that borrowing officially happen. So I guess time will tell. I'm sorry, that's not a clear answer for you.
Well, that's how the budget story's gone for the last several months anyway. Quick question. One revenue stream the governor didn't get was the Marcellus shale tax, the severance tax. Was this his best chance to get that?
I mean, there are a lot of folks who felt like the wind sort of came out of the sails once the budget was quote-unquote balanced. Because then you don't have that driving force of looking for new revenue to try and make things align. That being said, the House Democrats in particular have said that they are still going to push for a severance tax. We know the governor has still been pushing for a severance tax. So I guess we'll have to see how it all pans out. The shale tax bill that is currently before the House is hundreds of pages long and has a lot of amendments attached to it, some of which actually have to deal with shale drilling and some of which seem to be on more unrelated matters. So I think all eyes are going to be on the House when they return later this month to see whether they take up that bill, and if they do, which parts of it go through, if any.
Okay, in our remaining minute, I wanted to ask you about one of the bills, the status of it, and that is the education code, which also authorizes the spending for states' public schools. Where do we stand right now on that?
So right now the clock is ticking on that. My understanding is that the governor's office is interpreting the law to say that Sunday is the last day he could take action on that education code, and if he doesn't take action by then, it will lapse into law without his signature. So everybody's kind of watching the clock to see what happens there. This bill, while it does authorize the school spending, also has some policy changes in it, including some that are not particularly popular with teachers' unions who have been big supporters traditionally of the governor.
And that involves layoffs. Who could be laid off, correct?
Yes. That would make changes to how layoffs could be done. It would reduce or eliminate seniority protections and allow some performance-based evaluations to be used. Now, these performance evaluations are sort of controversial amongst the unions, with some people questioning how effective they actually are. That being said, the part I do not know at this point is how much ability, if any, the unions would have to put in their individual contracts measures that may or may not allow for seniority. But this would certainly open the door for districts to try and change the way that they would approach layoffs.
All right. Liz Navratil is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette covering the state capitol. Liz, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistance and research from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.